Welcome to Confessions of an Entrepreneur, powered by RG. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm absolutely thrilled today to be able to spend some time on my podcast with Peter Kirkham. For those of you who do not know Peter, Peter is not only someone who achieved significant success as a professional footballer for a number of clubs, including Newcastle United Football Club, but he also went on to build a significant property portfolio, losing everything and becoming bankrupt as a consequence of the credit crunch. He then, using his inner strength, resilience, and sheer determination to succeed, went from bankruptcy to building a successful business which he sold for millions of pounds within 6 years. I cannot wait today to find out a little bit more about what motivates Peter, how one dusts themselves off after adversity, and indeed, the things that perhaps he wishes he knew as a young entrepreneur that he now knows. Peter, first of all, I just wanted to start by thanking you for giving up some time today to feature on my Confessions of an Entrepreneur podcast.
No problem, no problem. Really excited to see what comes up. I'm not quite sure.
Temper your excitement level for sure, but nonetheless, genuinely, really great to be able to spend some time with you because I've known you for a long time. Only recently have we started to spend time together, so I'm really excited myself, actually, to find out a little bit more about you and what you've achieved personally and from a business perspective.
Okay.
So I guess from your perspective, it would be fantastic just to understand a little bit more about your upbringing.
Yeah.
If that's okay, Peter.
Yeah. So my dad was a sheet metal worker. My mum's a nurse, just real hard workers. And I'm so blessed with the parents. When you get to choose parents, I would choose them all day, every day. So I'm blessed with that. And they're very supportive of what I wanted to do in my life. But I was always, Carl, I always wanted to be a footballer,
Who doesn't, right?
It seemed a bit strange. Boy. Absolutely. And especially, it's okay when you're 8 or 9 saying, and you're at school, I want to be a footballer. But when I'm 16 and saying, I want to be a footballer, it's not as cool to stand up in class. But I always wanted to do that. And I was blessed with an ability, and I had a left foot, and which allegedly, which got me to where I needed to be, and I just always believed that I would be a footballer.
So, and where was home when you were first born? So where were you physically born and bred?
So I was born in Gateshead, Gateshead. Gosh. Obviously,
there's Geordie then.
Geordie come in, So Gateshead, even though I live in Sunderland now.
To the bright side.
Yes, exactly. Well, my son, he goes to school and he reads books, but I've got to say, son, school, books, that's young Miles. So yeah, it was another great little footballer.
And you mentioned there that you were born with a phenomenal left foot. Let me ask a question. Do you think that is true? And by that I mean, do you believe in nature, or do you believe nurture is perhaps what gave you the ability to be successful as a footballer?
So I think you've got to have a gift, right? So you've got to have an ability, but you've got to work on it every day. I was with a ball all of the time with Dad on the top field, on the top. Every night, Dad with the ball, he was with us all the time, playing football, and always keeping up, keeping the ball open. There was one time at school, I think I was maybe his third year junior. I don't even know what that year is now. So before, and the dinner lady, I was up to breaking my record. I was up to about 800, 900 keepy-ups. What would I have been? 10-year-old, something like that. And the dinner lady actually said, just keep doing it. So all the kids went back to class and I'm keeping my record and doing that. So I was just always with the ball. So it absolutely need ability, but you've got to practice. If you look at Ronaldo and Messi, if you look at those, why they're at the very top, yes, God-given ability, but they are dedicated, they work hard, adversity, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later on, but you need all of that. And we'll talk about the football journey later, but I didn't realise that. I thought ability was enough. It's not.
No.
And then when I've kind of went full circle in business, well, I know you've got to outwork everyone.
Yeah.
Every day, if you've got that desire and you really want to be where you want to be, you've got to absolutely outwork everyone, which I didn't do with football.
Mm. And you've mentioned there that, you know, your old man would often take you to the top pitch, and you'd play football hours on end. I mean, do you think your dad had a massive impact on your success when it comes to football? I.e., if your dad wasn't supportive, if he didn't like football, if he wasn't the type of dad who was around, and do you think that might have had a negative impact on what you could achieve?
So I think what my dad did was make things easier for us, and he had a passion for football, and he believed in me, and he still does. I'm still thinking he thinks I can make a nail, and I'm nearly 50. But he just gave me that platform, and when you've got that, and then my mum. She's not my mother, I don't call her mother. My mum, she says, she always said, if you want anything badly enough, you'll make it happen. If you want it badly enough, you can make anything's possible. So, and at the time, I didn't really listen to that, but the drive that my mum had, you know, my dad was brilliant for bringing out the best of us in the football. So I am truly blessed.
Okay. And obviously, I've now got sort of pictures of you, you know, literally mourning. Daytime, evening, with a ball. Almost like the footballing sort of Billy Elliot of the Northeast, if you will. So with that in mind...
I'm a good dancer as well, so I'll let you say that. In my opinion.
We all have strengths and weaknesses, and I'll leave it there for sure, Peter. But let me ask, so obviously when you were during school hours, you know, doing keep-ups in the playground and at home, probably dedicating your entire existence to football, how did you find time for education and for study?
So, again, my mum used to really, really make me focus on that as well. And I did well at school. And even when I ended up signing for Newcastle, I went, when all the guys were playing, so we had to go to in college on the day release on the Thursday. Right. And some of our, how can I put this nicely, some of the less qualified GCSE guys, they went to, did colouring in and played football and stuff. And then and I went on a BTEC National. So I had to go all the way down to Middlesbrough and do this BTEC National thing. But then my mum said, look, come on, you can do an A-level as well. So whilst the guys were playing snooker, I'm at A-level night school doing an extra A-level as well as a BTEC National. So there was always that drive and to always get out of my comfort zone, really.
And if your mum hadn't sent you to do an A-level outside of normal sort of education hours, do you think you'd have, on your own back, been inspired to do that? Or do you think, again, is this, you know, as a consequence of your parents encouraging you early?
I mean, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have done it. Without my mum, I wouldn't have done that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Absolutely not.
So you just touched on, you know, your pinnacle when it comes to your footballing career, which was being signed for Newcastle. Could you just tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so when I was 12 year old, I played for a team called Reckington, and Reckington were the worst team in the league, in the under-12s league. We had a great bunch of guys, and we were the best when we were under-12, and I think then coming under-13 age, we were into the big league with all the big boys, and so we were playing against the top teams, and I played, and I think we got beat 7-1 against a team called Hilda Park, and I got the one. But I used to love that. I used to love playing against the best teams. We weren't the strongest team, but a great bunch of lads and good players in that team as well. But I loved that adversity, going right up against the big boys. Come on, then, I'll take you on. And I ended up getting scouted that game and signed for Newcastle United in the School of Excellence. So I went there for a year. Thought I'd done great at the end of that year. Got a letter through because it wasn't emails. Isn't that letters?
Good old-fashioned Royal Mail.
Yeah, trees and everything, you know, save the trees. So I got a letter through saying you've been released. Now, a 12-year-old.
And presumably that wasn't expected, Peter. So you thought you'd played phenomenally well for 12 months. You thought this was a contract.
I couldn't believe it. And I was devastated.
Mm.
And you know, crying, and my mum and dad were gutted, but trying to be positive for me. And that was my first bit of it. I mean, there's a little bit of adversity prior to that, but that was the first time I said, you know what? I'm going to prove you right. I'm going to prove you wrong. Right? I am going to, every time Newcastle United come to watch me now, I'm going to be the best player on the pitch. I will show you. And I took it that way rather than sometimes you'll see kids will go, all right, I've been released. I'm not good enough. I can't believe this happened to me. I'm so unlucky. Just went, right, they think that watches. And I kind of got that attitude. It was pretty much when I was 11-year-old, I had bad flu and I wanted to play for the district team. I played for the district team and I ended up getting pneumonia. And it damaged my lungs. So the doctor came. Doctors used to come out to your house then.
Right.
So right. How old am I? So the doctor came out and he said, look, he's got asthma. And mum, dad, he wants to be fresh off footballer. Will he be able to? Look, I'm sorry.
Was that the diagnosis for asthma? So you had asthma until that point?
Until the doctor came out and said, you've got asthma. And said to my mum and dad, look, he's never going to be a professional footballer. He's just going to be, he played, but he's not going to improve. And again, devastated. Doctor telling you, you know, it's like, oh, God. And I went, right, I am going to do it. So pretty much, I think the way to get me doing stuff is say, you can't do that, I think. And I still haven't figured that out.
There's a few things in there I'd love to just unpack, Peter, because people watching this podcast, you know, perhaps have been presented with challenges.
Yeah.
They may have faced brick walls before.
Yeah.
And then they have tried and tried again not had breakthrough. So what do you do when you face adversity to fundamentally keep your mental resilience to succeed? How do you sort of recalibrate on the back of really, really bad news?
Well, I guess there's a state of mind. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. You can influence your state at any time, how you breathe, right, how you sit. For example, in the challenges we have in business every day, something but it's like you can either feel sorry for yourself or if you're sitting slumped, or you can go, right, first of all, I need to change my state. I speak quicker, I speak faster. I'm doing so. When I change my state, then I have certainty. Mm-hmm. I then have certainty when I do. Now, certainty then means that I will then take new actions, and then new actions equals new results. So it starts from at any time you achieve. We are God-given blessed to be able every single day to have free will, right? To be able to choose what we want to do. We've talked about this in the past, to choose. It is my choice to feel sorry for myself, or it is my choice, as I'll talk about, you know, with the challenge, which I'm sure we'll cover later. It is my choice to feel sorry for myself or to change my state. And how you change your state is the power of your questions. Simple as that. If I ask rubbish questions, I'll get rubbish answers. Your brain's a computer. If I ask great questions, I'll get great answers. Does that make sense?
It does. And obviously, certain viewers watching this podcast might say, well, it's grand saying that, mm-hmm. but if you have supportive parents who are willing to sacrifice everything to give you the opportunities you've had, you've had it easier than perhaps, you know, a young child looking to play football who had disruptive parents who weren't supportive, who didn't take them to Sunderland games.
Yes.
What would you say to that person? Because they might say, I've got no chance.
Yeah.
I've not got the support that I need to succeed.
Yeah.
So what do you say to that person?
I would say, whatever you if you think you're right, you think you're wrong, you're right. Right? So if you feel as though you're a victim, you'll be a victim. Right? If you feel as though whatever happens, I'm going to do this, it will happen. That is one thing I'm really passionate about. Because I get all the time, I get excuses. I hear excuses every day, every single day, instead of because people aren't asking the right questions. And my dad, by the way, he was a sheet metal worker and he had to work in the shipyards, horrendous conditions. Like horrendous.
Really,
and he had to go and do that. My mum was in work night shift for I don't know how many years. Everyone advised then their family, you know, you shouldn't be buying your own house, you should have a council. I was just scrimping saved to do that. So, you know, we were totally working class people. But with that work ethic, that's what I got from my mum and dad, the work ethic. So I'm blessed on that. I'd like to think they did absolutely give us a pathway to do it. But my mum doesn't know business. My dad doesn't know business. It's fun. We have some fun with it now, you know. They just say, "Look, whatever." When I'm saying I want to do this, and I want to do that. They're very cautious. I like to take calculated risks, but I love getting myself out of my comfort zone, which I'll probably talk about a little bit later on a few other projects, but that's it.
Yeah, I think what you said there is fascinating because obviously it seems your parents, Peter, were very hardworking.
Yep.
Very keen to give you perhaps what they hadn't been given.
Yep.
And were willing to sacrifice everything in pursuit of giving you everything.
Yep.
And we'll come back to some of those principles a little later, actually, because I think to succeed, there has to be sacrifice.
Of course.
And I think some people would argue that that isn't true and sacrifice isn't a positive thing. But I think it is, because only then do you appreciate when you succeed.
We'll
circle back to that later.
Yeah, yeah.
You talked a lot there about being able to choose your state of mind, being able to choose how you view challenges as an opportunity to get on.
Yeah.
And therefore you sort of imply that perhaps you can dictate how successful you are. Do you therefore believe in the law of attraction? And just to be clear for viewers, that is all about visualizing what you want, and those things will just happen. Do you believe in that principle?
So absolutely do that in the book The Secret and things like that. Now, but what I do know is there is no guarantee.
Mm.
But what I also know is it will significantly improve the chances of it happening. And that's all you can do.
So some people talk about, and Rhona Byrne, who wrote The Secret, of course, who I think is a phenomenal author, and I've read her three books and all of the independent surveys that she did before writing The Power, of course, was the sequel to The Secret. The one thing she talks about precisely, and I'd love to get your view on this, is the fact that fundamentally, if you visualize things, but you have to really feel, believe, see, taste the being successful to ultimately bring into existence success. Her view is anyone can do it.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a pretty direct question. Have you in the past had a mood board where you've had pictures of the things that to you symbolize success? Have you done that? Because that's one of the practices she talks about.
So I don't have a mood board as such. When I was younger, my friends, we used to take the mick out of my car. It was unbelievable. I used to have an old Fiesta, right? And I love my cars. It was a Fiesta 1.1 LX.
You were messing around.
And I used to dream, when I used to go to Dalton, play at Dalton every day, I used to dream one day I'd have a Mondeo so I could actually overtake a lorry. Because as soon as you got to a hill, I had to cut back in and wait till I'm up there. And I just thought, one day I could have a Mondeo. And now I love overtaking cars. But it's the, I used to have a tape cassette. I mean, I'm showing really old. I'm not old. And there was a tip, and in that I used to have your Anthony Robbins motivational stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mate, she used to, oh, what happy clappy stuff you've got today.
What age was this, Peter? Just to
so this was when I found Anthony Robbins, who was unbelievable.
I agree.
About 24.
Yeah.
So that mixing with Rich Dad Poor Dad really transformed my way of thinking.
So what's your view on this? And then we'll talk a little bit about, I guess, you know, the height of your footballing career.
Yeah, yeah.
But let me ask, we've just talked there about being able to choose your state of mind, being able to bring to reach anything and everything, as long as you can sense, feel, touch, and smell what success is for you. What would you say to someone who says, well, I have a life-threatening illness, or something just really unlucky has happened to me, which has completely thrown a spanner in all of what we are discussing here? What would you say to that person? Because they may say, fundamentally, my luck is not going to ever come good because I'm unlucky.
Yeah.
What's our view on that?
So again, no matter what, you know, your gift could be having football ability. Your gift could be suffering. Your gift could be anything that you're able to inspire people if you so choose to do. And for people will have challenges and you know, like health. And that is one thing that you can have all the money in the world, everything. If you haven't got your health, you've got nothing. So you've got to do the best you can to look after yourself. But I just think anybody who's got those challenges, and who am I to ever say, because I've never been involved with that. I had a close friend who had motor neurons disease, and I watched him deteriorate. Real close friend of mine, and I've seen it firsthand, and it is horrendous. But what he chose to do is, and when me and him used to speak, because we're really close, a guy called Keith Holway, and when we talked about it, I used to say to him, he knew his time was limited. And I said, look, in this time, you've got a choice. You can either let the illness do this to you and you go with it, or you go and inspire everyone. Yeah, I'm getting emotional. You go and inspire everyone you speak to.
Yep.
And the next day he's on Facebook and he's inspiring, and people were looking. People think they've got problems in their life, seeing Keith going, putting on that motivational post and going, wow, he's just made me, inspire me to do something in your life. And I think what I would love to do with legacy or whatever you call it, I love inspiring people to believe that they do better, whatever it is, whatever ailment or whatever challenge or financial or whatever you have. You know, life's going to be tough, isn't it? No matter what. And it's going to be tough if you let life beat you, right? Or it's going to be tough if you want to try and make it go over. So choose your tough, isn't it? Choose your tough. That's kind of, does that answer your question?
It does. Really inspiring. It absolutely does. And I guess the point you're making is, you know, we're all going to be dealt cards.
Yes.
It's all about how you choose to play yours.
Absolutely.
And you can either play a really strong, considered, focused hand.
Yeah.
With one objective, which is to achieve what you inspire.
Yeah.
Or you can accept defeat early.
Yeah.
Your call.
Yes.
I guess is the point you're making.
Absolutely.
So back to your footballing career. So just take me to the pinnacle of your footballing career, because you talked there about getting the letter from Newcastle United,
yes,
whereby they effectively released you, which of course was devastating.
Yeah.
Take me right now to the point whereby you sat back and thought, this is footballing success.
So when, 16-year-old, I'd signed for Ipswich prior to that, 14-year-old. My dad wouldn't let us sign for anyone until I was 14. Didn't have agents or anything like that. Or the only agent was Lund Polly or Here's Trouble or something like that. But so an agent. So what I did was I had a choice to sign for Sheffield United, Wimbledon, when they won the old Premier League or First Division, and Ipswich. So them were the three clubs, and I chose Ipswich. And it was brilliant. I got my boots, my tracksuit, everything. And then every school holiday, like, so this is from 14 to 16, every school holiday, I'm on travel 7 hours on a bus to Ipswich. So that soon ran out. And Newcastle used to come and watch us. And I remember my manager at the time saying, Newcastle interested in you? I went, what? So I ended up signing, re-signed for Newcastle at 16. Mr. Keegan came.
Yep.
And he said, you know, I want to build a team with Geordies. That lasted around 6 months. He realised, right, I need to buy.
That's right, when he saw me as well.
Absolutely. So I was like, right. So then he released the majority of youngsters, I think 2 or 3 later. Didn't even have a reserve team. And then I had an opportunity to go to Dalton, who were League Two at the time. And I also had an opportunity to go to Sunderland, to Jim Montgomery, the old Sunderland goalkeeper, another great guy, and a guy called George Hurd as well. So they said to come to Sunderland, but I went to Dalton first and loved it. Absolutely loved it. So Dalton said, look, there's a one-year contract. If you go and try it at Sunderland, it won't be here. So I went, you know what, I've tried it at a big club. I didn't get a chance. I'm going to try it at a small club. And the pinnacle for me was when I made my debut. So I was 18-year-old. Dalton hadn't won a game all season. The manager, Alan Murray, said, Peter, you're starting on Tuesday night when it was against Colchester. Dalton hadn't won. We won 7-3. And if you go on the internet and my little ridiculously rubbish Wikipedia page, you'll in the fans' forums, I've still get unbelievable feedback from the Dalton fans, even now, which is amazing. And they get asked to go and do little bits of talks and things like that. Because the time that I played, I didn't play that much, but when I played, I used to be twos and threes and fours and step overs and skills, and probably not right in League Two, but my debut, winning 7-3 with all my family, thinking, I can do this. And that was probably the pinnacle of my football career. And then I was doing well that first year. Sheffield United beat 80,000 for me. The club turned it down. And one of my friends at the time said, go and see Mr. Chairman and say it. And I went to the chairman's. But I didn't do it for about a month. So I went after that month And I've read in the Gazette, in the Evening Gazette down in Middlesbrough, club bid for youngster. And I went to the chairman about a month, 6 weeks later, and I said, "Mr. Chairman, have a word." "Yeah, yeah. I understand Sheffield United have bid 80,000 for me." And so I'm just wondering. He said, "Yeah, they bid 80,000. It's unsatisfactory, 180,000. You concentrate on playing football. I'll concentrate on running the club." And I went, "All right, okay," and went. Well, imagine now, I'd be saying, get loan pulling me, travelling, get me agent in. I'm not pleased. But it was a different world there, it was. And that was my first time that I go, when I look back on that, nobody will ever dictate my future ever again. And that was a kind of a great lesson. Because I'm reshaped at all different. People say, you don't change. You absolutely change through your lessons in life. Absolutely.
Again, it depends on whether you choose to change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, so that was it. And then 3 years later, I'd left, been released from football, fell out with the manager. Probably not worth saying on the podcast what I thought of that particular manager who I left, and I ended up having to train with the reserves for 6 months in the juniors. So, and then I just said I had enough of football, which is a shame.
And given just how which you sacrificed to get to that point.
Yeah.
Given how focused you were throughout your entire life to that point.
Yeah.
Why did you decide at that time to jack it in?
It was, I fell out of love.
And what do you think sort of ultimately resulted in you falling out of love with the thing that you loved the most for your entire life to that time?
So the obviously the manager at the time made it. The chairman really rated me and the chairman and the manager didn't get on. Right. So I got took out one.
Now,
if I'm younger, that's what I would say, that, you know, it was the manager. But me now is because I didn't want it badly enough. Because on getting released then, what I should have done is every day. So any lesson to anyone released from football, get out there, hit the roads, get the training, work until you get an opportunity back in. I gave up.
And why though? Because of course, because I'm rewind,
and well, I lost
you got
my
that
belief.
Letter from Newcastle, and they yes. didn't renew and didn't issue a contract.
Yeah.
You just dusted yourself off and got on with it.
Yeah.
What do you think it was at that time which led you to not do that?
I let people believe I wasn't, when they told me I wasn't good enough. I believed
them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that never happens again. Unless it's dancing or something, you know, unless I went on Strictly, they'll tell us I'm not good. But the I let someone believe, and it is my responsibility. It's not that poor managers, poor as in not very good, not as in no feel sorry. It wasn't him. It is all on me. Because if I was good enough, people say it, even now, I put myself up ability-wise, Carl, against anybody. Even now, right? Ability-wise. But skill is only that part of it.
Yeah.
Dedication, consistency, belief, adversity, all of that is 80% of it.
Yeah, the attitude and
absolutely. When you have challenges, and I didn't learn that till later on in the day. And if I, you know, you give you advice to a young one and any up and coming youngster, you get setbacks, you go to show people. You outwork every single person. If you follow your Messi, your Ronaldo, you go and outwork people, you go make it happen. So that's how I. After a little stint in Sweden, Svenska, after on loan, I was in. That was amazing, absolutely unbelievable. What an experience! I was living in a place in Sweden. We were in a penthouse. It was myself and a guy from Portugal, Jose, and he couldn't speak any English. I couldn't speak any Portuguese, and we both couldn't speak any Swedish. So that was fun. But I loved my time there. They wanted me to sign and that. And I really contemplated moving lock, stop and borrow, but I wanted to try again back in the UK. And it just, yeah. So that was then football done and dusted. And yeah, so that was, I had the opportunity with Sheffield United when I went down and did that trial with them. And the Wally Downs was the assistant manager at the time, said, "Peter, you'll be here within a month. Just get your head down. We'll love what we see." And then it's obviously the club turned it down. But I am so lucky that I've had this.
Yeah, what a phenomenal journey as a young man living his dream as a professional footballer, right? So many young footballing talents try and absolutely don't get some of the opportunities yes you had, so you rather celebrate your success. Yeah.
I should have done better. I didn't do good enough. You know, that I should have done much better. If you speak to my dad, my uncle Phil, you know, they'll tell you, I should have done better. And I know I should have done better, but that's on me.
Sure,
nobody else.
Sure.
That's on
but me. Hey, you know, I think everything's relative, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
And whilst there's always a Ronaldo, the point
yes
actually, as long as you achieve and as long as you feel content with your achievement and that success,
of course,
it's wrong to draw comparisons.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously, at that point, you know, you perhaps accepted that professional football was yep a thing of the past, and perhaps yep it would now be a sport you love, but yep nothing more.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you went from being, you know, a very successful acclaimed footballer into business, because for those watching this podcast might not see the obvious way
the, from oh yeah ex-footballers not business really business yeah, but I've used so much that I've learned from football even now in my business mentality with dressing room mentality yeah and stuff. But yeah, so I really struggled coming out of football, really struggled for a few years. I was playing part-time, getting good money playing part-time, but really thinking didn't know what I wanted to do.
And is that because in your mind at that time, the only thing you were really good at was football? Did you not know what other skills you had to leverage? Is that a challenge?
I knew I was quite clever. You know, like for GCSEs, A in maths, A in business studies, A in English. So I knew I was quite clever, even though, I could have tried harder at school. But I just knew I wanted a better life. And at 25-year-old, I remember borrowing a fiver from my dad for petrol, because I had very little. And he said, son, when's this going to change? And that hit me right in the heart. 25-year-old asking to borrow fiver. And when I say borrow fiver off my dad, no, I ain't paying that back. As much as I'd love to. And that was the changing point. Yeah. That was it. And I then, Anthony Robbins, I then wanted to, you know, got into sales, which is the most important skill you'll ever acquire. And there's a story on sales, and I'll demonstrate a little bit of my different sales process compared to anyone else's.
Please.
Sure, and I'll do that when I sold the business. I'll talk about that. But yes, so I wanted to didn't quite know where I wanted to be. And anyway, what I did was I borrowed £3,000 and I bought my first property.
Mm, that £3,000, was that off your parents?
That was off my parents, yep. Yes. So I borrowed £3,000 and bought my first property. And there was two properties in a place called, was it the Royal Keys mm-hmm in North Shields?
Yeah, indeed.
But if you speak to my mates, they'll say it was a flat in the Meadowell. So it's either way of what it was, either way I loved it, right? So I've got that, and there was two houses for sale, or two flats for sale. One that I'm doing this, what am I doing this for? One was at the top, one was at the bottom. And there were £65,000. And I bid 58 for both, and they were identical. One said yes, one said no. Because one was a motivated seller. Ah, right. So motivated seller. So what I then did was I bought that, and prices went up at that time. So I remortgaged and I bought a place in Hebburn.
Was this for you to live in? Sorry, people.
So this was to live in, yes. So I lived in that. And then it went up in value, and I remortgaged and I bought a place outright at a flat in Hebburn. So I bought that outright for 21 and a half. And I remember at the time saying, I'm not getting ripped off. I'm not paying 22,000. And really, you pay out for that now, hindsight. And so I did that. And then a couple of years went past, reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I went on a course. I went, you know what? I am going for it. I remortgaged a lot and bought 16 the following year.
And before you did that, so when you were living in your now owned property,
yes.
What were you actually doing day to day? I mean, did you have a job? Were you generating income, Peter, or were you just sitting down working out what comes next for you?
Yes, I was in sales,
in
BT, Yellow Pages, Sage. So I had great time, great learnings in Sage, where I met actually Graham Wiley.
Proper frontline sales.
Yes, and then I got a leadership role in that, selling mobiles.
Yeah.
So I got a job as my first ever leadership role, because I always thought as a leader, because I'd had poor managers in the past and good managers, I always wanted to manage people how I would like to be treated. And that really inspired me to do that, because getting the best out of me didn't used to be in football in its time was, you're rubbish, you're crap, get your finger out, you're effing blind and that. And I was used to that world. But I was sort of, you know, if someone put their arm around me and said, you do this, you do that, I had to run through brick walls for you. And I think that man management, I've really, really took that to heart and tried to hone that the best I can.
How does that though reconcile with something you said earlier, which is actually when you were a young, inspiring footballer, the thing that motivated you the most was when people gave you tough love.
Yes.
They said, you're not good enough.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So just reconcile that for me, because that's a slight contradiction. Yes.
Yeah. So that was... So that wasn't something that someone direct saying that to my face or anything on that. I'm inspired to prove people wrong.
Right. It's a concept rather than someone saying you're not good enough.
So whereas that day-to-day thing, I would still prove them wrong.
Sure.
But what I'm saying is you would have got an even better result out of me.
Yes.
If you would have said this week.
Yeah, positive inspiration.
Absolutely.
Versus...
And told at the right time. Yeah. And, you know, but you would have got an even better result out of me. I would have still found a way. I would have still shown you. But you would have got a better result at that.
It does. That makes sense. Actually, and sorry, I interrupted you. You were just talking about how you went from the one property that you lived in to a dozen properties. Just sort of help me understand how you got from A to Z.
So what I was doing was buying. You could then buy and remortgage. So buying at a discount, doing up and
these were all buy-to-let properties.
And buy-to-let properties. Yeah. And then sitting with 18 properties and taking on the world. And I thought, I can't do this quick enough. So I got my financial advisor at the time. Bear in mind, I couldn't get a £50 overdraft 3 years earlier. What I did was, from the age of 27 to 31, I then changed £3,000 into £3.5 million worth of property. Portfolio.
And these were all residential properties that you had bought, perhaps refurbed, and you were renting out.
Yes.
All in the northeast?
Yep. All local.
And to anyone watching this podcast who perhaps, you know, financially is in a similar situation to the situation you were in, which is, you know, you didn't have much capital and you didn't really understand how to create wealth at that time.
Yes.
I mean, what would your advice be? Because they would say, well, Peter, that's when properties you could buy for 20 grand. That's when you can go and get, you know, a 110% LTV residential mortgage, which you can't now. So what would you say to that person who says, but I couldn't achieve that now?
So my nana, when she bought her first house and she was driven to buy it, that was £5,000. That was a lot of money. When my mum and dad bought their first house, that was £18,000, I believe that. I mean, they may watch us and say, no, it was 24, but I'm sure it was £18,000. That was a lot of money.
Sorry.
£22,000 for a flat when I was first on was a lot of money. Prices now are a lot of money. Wherever along that journey of property investing, it will always be a lot of money what you pay.
Yeah, in relative terms to you at that time.
So, but rents are as well.
Yeah.
So in relative, and you just got to work out which is the deal that you can make your profit in order to, you know, to grow or scale. My goal was to have financial freedom. That was my goal. It wasn't to have 50 properties or was to give me the opportunity to choose what I wanted to do.
Yes, yes.
And then at the age of 31, I had my first retirement. I was working at Yellow Pages at the time and I just went, I was in a meeting one day and I just thought, I'm not doing this anymore. I've got these properties. I'm just going to do that and got my car and all of that malarkey. Because I love my cars and that.
And was that your Mondeo that you didn't
No, I
you
know what?
Did you upgrade
slightly? Funnily enough, I didn't go for the Mondeo in the end.
Didn't? That was disappointing. You said that the Mondeo was on your mood board.
That was my dream at the time. I thought, we'd just overtake that lorry on a hill.
But here's relativity for you, right? Because at the time, a Mondeo was success.
Absolutely. Of course, for me.
Molded on, not what it intended. Perhaps you overtook the Mondeo.
Well, it's the same as my biggest ever goal was to have a sports car and a Jeep.
So what car did you buy then? I need to ask.
So back then it was a Porsche 911.
Right.
So convertible, which I loved and obsessed. Couldn't really afford it, but I always, when I was younger, I wanted to show people that I was successful when
what,
I wasn't.
What does that mean?
I don't know if it's because of, I believe, failing at football, other people would be saying success at football. So I don't know if it was that, and I just always wanted to impress people I was successful. When I sold my business...
And sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Because there's a few things you've said there.
Yeah, no, no,
got,
no, sorry.
Got
yeah.
to talk about.
Yeah.
So at the age of 31,
yeah.
you're 9/11.
Yes.
All of these rental
yeah, yeah.
properties.
Yeah.
Why did you care what anyone thought of you? And why did you want people to think, Peter is now successful? Why is that important? As long as you know.
I think seeing football, you always have to be the best. You always have to win.
Have to be perceived as the best or have to be the best? Because, of course, those can be different things.
Of course, that's a fair point. When I got spotted, we weren't the best team. But I was perceived as the best player on the pitch at that time to get scouted.
Yeah.
But I wasn't. It wasn't the best, but I was perceived to be the best. And I think now, if you think I'm great, great. If you think I'm not great, I don't. Of course, I care, but I don't really care.
What's changed then? So obviously, you said at 31 you cared about other people's opinion of you, but now you're saying you don't care. So what's actually changed then?
So I think reaching the success probably that I've got to now, that was true success.
Right.
I think that bit before was, look at these, I've got these properties, I've got this house, I've got, I'm a property entrepreneur, that type of thing. That, I just wanted people to believe I was successful. And again, I can't quite figure that out. You actually, it's like a counselling session. This, I'm really racist. I'm looking at my window going, what the hell was that? But yeah, now I do. What you see is what you get. It's if you think I'm successful, great. If you don't, great.
But just to ask a really pointed question, because I think we've sort of stumbled on something here, which I think is really quite fascinating. Because a lot of people, yourself included, spend a big proportion of their life trying to be perceived in a particular way.
Yeah.
And almost therefore putting other people's opinion of themselves.
Absolutely.
Before their own opinion of themselves.
Absolutely.
Just talk me through how you perhaps would encourage people to focus more on their own belief in their own success and achievement. Because fundamentally, when all is said and done, that is all that matters.
Of course. And happiness is a choice, right? Whatever it is. But what... Some people want to do stuff for... the mums and dads, and they want to do it for... And you've got to ask yourself, what will make me truly happy? Is it the cars, the houses, the families? Whatever that is that makes you happy. And then do those things more. And if it's business, well, brilliant.
Yep.
Brilliant. If it's creating business, selling business, well, I love selling business. Love it. That makes you happy. So you do more of it.
Yep.
And if you're able to do a role or do something or a hobby or anything that you love, like when I'd go running on a treadmill, I really hate running. Always hate running because of pre-season was horrendous. But now, what I do is Monday to Friday, when my cough's not, I nearly said knacked there. My Geordie, I'm coming out as a Geordie again, when me injured. I've run 2.5K, but on that 2.5K, I've got my AirPods in and I'm learning. So now I enjoy running because I'm not just running, I'm learning, I'm doing that, and I still want to play on a Wednesday night with the lads. I still want to be the best. Yeah, even though I'm the oldest there, I want to be the best every week. So that running is a means to an end, but I also do enjoy and learn. I'm so eager to learn now all of the time. Does that answer?
It does. And I interrupted the flow, so you were kindly talking about, I guess, the point whereby you... as a sales professional, decided this job just isn't interesting, isn't inspiring. Quite frankly, I'm getting off the treadmill. Yeah. At that point, how many properties did you own and what was the value of that portfolio?
So the properties at that time, so I went to 80, so I had about 45 to 50 properties and half of them were empty. And this is what happened, then the credit crunch came. So I'd retired, made it.
You had about 50 residential properties.
Yes, about that, about 45, I'd say, something like that.
And just as a reminder, over what period of time
4 years.
You go from having
nothing.
£3,000.
Nothing to 4 years.
50 residential properties. Yeah.
To 4 years. It took
4 years. Wow.
4 years. But I had something called a commercial facility then. I had the banks lined up. The banks give, I'll not say which bank gives it, but the credit crunch came and the bank in question then changed the terms of the
right.
of the loan, the value.
Pulled the facility.
Which meant that, pulled the facility.
So what happened next?
So at the age of 38, I chose to go bankrupt. So I lost everything. Everything. I used to have a lovely apartment. I used to get out with a freezing cold shower because my gas and electric had been cut off. Got out of that shower, freezing straight in, straight out, get ready to, oh, what's that buzzing noise? Oh, what's going on now? Is it the boiler? I hear a buzzing noise. I'm getting into the fridge or something. I went in, buzzing noise, and it's a bailiff drilling my door with all the neighbours watching.
No.
And I'm like,
God.
I'm sure there's a perfectly reasonable explanation. Was a bailiff. Come in, short. And I got my car towed away, repossessed in front of my work colleagues.
Oh, it's getting that fixed. Was a surprise, and by that I mean, this was coming?
So, I chose.
Yeah, so to go. None of
the,
that.
The only people I owed was the banks.
Yeah.
The bank. And I chose, and I couldn't afford it. I tried my best. I had to find £4,000, £5,000 a month before I even got out of bed to pay for my. It was just the most horrendous time ever. And I thought, and I've heard someone say this before, I thought the tightrope was 50 metres in the air. And actually, it was 6 inches off the ground. And when the judge, with the bankruptcy and authorised the bankruptcy, you could see he looked at us and I told him a story. And you could see, he felt sorry for us that, you've tried, it didn't work. And the hardest thing was sitting in front of my parents. They don't know bankruptcy. And I sat down, I said...
And so it's like, because I was asking, so had your parents appreciated how much wealth you'd created at that point? Was it quite obvious that you had built this property?
Yeah, because of the car and the nice houses. Yeah,
okay, so they knew that you had achieved financial success at that point.
And I hid it, and then I sat them down. I just said, Mum, Dad, and I said, look, I'm going bankrupt. I'm going to lose everything.
Wow.
And I said, but let me tell you, I promise you, I'm going to get it back. And I'm going to get it more than I've ever had.
And how did your folks respond?
And my mum and dad, it gives them that confidence that I wasn't beaten. They were devastated for me. Devastated.
They were physically sad. They were really worried about you, presumably. Yeah,
but then I went, but I promise you, I'm going to get it back. And I think it gives them the confidence to go, I believe him. And then I went from bankrupt to millionaire within and 6 years.
So obviously the day the 9/11 was towed away, the day the bailiff was drilling a hole in your front door.
Yeah.
I mean, how did that absolutely make you feel? I mean, whilst I respect what you've just said there about dusting yourself off and saying, I can get back to where I was, there must have been a point where you thought, to hell with this.
Yeah.
I'm done. My luck's out. I'm just going to sit at home, open a bottle of wine, and, the rest will be history. I mean, surely there must have been a dark moment.
Though I was at my lowest point. Lowest point. And at that time I went, you know what? I'm just going to lock myself away.
Yeah.
And I locked myself away and I watched motivational videos all day. All day. Rocky, Rocky's on the scene and he's, when life hits you and it's not about how hard you hit, how hard you get hit and keep moving forward, those ones. The Any Given Sunday, Al Pacino speech, the motivational stuff, Anthony Robbins, and I absolutely immersed myself for a day, or about 6 hours, in nothing but motivational. And at the end of it, I went, I'm ready.
Really?
I am ready.
Wow. Was there someone, a person, and I don't mean Al Pacino or Bruno Byrne, I mean, was there a mate, a family member, a friend, a colleague, a mentor, who you relied on to get you out of the worst position you'd ever been in? I mean, or was it just all you helping you?
Well, the first thing I had to do myself, at the time I had a business partner, and we really helped each other. He was going through challenging times, I was going through challenging times, so it was the only person that could speak to regarding that. It was a massive help, and
right.
You know, never forget that. But ultimately, it was I had to have my mindset.
Mm.
I had to do it for myself. I had to do whatever you surround yourself with. I had to do that, and I was ready to take on the world. I remember sitting my business partner Johnson, great, brilliant guy, and I remember saying, "See my account there. There's 37 pence in my account. You will never see that again. Never." Now, that might mean I've only have 34 pence in my account, but you'll never see that again. And touch wood, it's went from there. Obviously, loads of challenges in business, but which is another story.
And was there ever a time before you found yourself back on an upward trajectory? Was there ever a time where you thought, you know what? No, actually, life's got me. I'm done. I'm knackered. My luck is just run out. Was there ever a time where you were going to just throw the proverbial towel in? Because the way you describe it makes it sound like you went bankrupt and the following day you were running a business. Clearly, that's not the case. Was there ever a moment where you questioned...
It took me 12 months to just get a job and get through, because all I wanted to do was get through my bankruptcy.
Yes.
I just wanted to get through that and discharged after 12 months. And then about 6 months after that, set up the business, and just 6 months or 12 months after that. But the first 12 months was just find my feet, get skills, you know, hone my skills, decide what I want to do, find a way, survive just for that. So that 12-month period, and then after that, it was right. Full systems go. Take on the world. And that was.
I mean, it's really interesting because we talked earlier about why in your sort of early career you were more focused on people's perception of you than your own view of yourself.
Yes.
And actually, I think perhaps going bankrupt when you are laid bare, you are naked, the world see financial failure.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it takes for you to then realize that what people think doesn't matter, because actually people already know that financially one is rock bottom, and therefore maybe that is why now you are fully focused on your view of your own success and your view of your own standing.
Yeah.
Because people will always have their opinion.
Of course.
Right or wrong.
Of course.
So to move on, so obviously, you know, it's inspiring, Peter, to hear that you were able to largely choose to go again and to seek success again, having built a phenomenal property portfolio, which fundamentally you lost.
Yes.
So
because of me,
I'm inspired by how you were able to recalibrate.
Yep.
Not everyone perhaps would have chose to do that.
Mm-hmm.
From the point in time you were bankrupt, to the point in time you sold your business, what was the amount of time that had lapsed?
So from bankrupt to millionaire, or whatever, it was 6 years.
6 years. And given this podcast only is of a certain duration, I'm going to have to try and focus on one or two key moments within that journey. But my first sort of question, Peter, which I'd love to talk a little bit about, is so when you sold your business for the first time, and appreciate some of this may be confidential, so only tell me what you can.
Yep.
What did that mean to you? And I mean now financially.
Yeah.
Given, you know, perhaps 6 years prior, where you found yourself.
Yes. Yes. So, first of all, the bankruptcy really humbled me.
Mm.
Really humbled me. I am so blessed now. I'm grateful every night. I say thank you to God for what I have. I am so blessed and grateful. And that got to set my family up for life.
So like
got
anything I want. Independence.
Absolutely.
So yep.
Got my dream home, dream car. Remember speaking at the time on the phone with the CEO at the time on the day of the transaction. when the solicitor said funds are en route. And I remember being talking about, oh, we'll announce it this way. And then I'm like this on my phone, refresh. And when the funds hit, it was just the most phenomenal feeling. I'm on the phone to the CEO and I said, well, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go. I've got my dream car, which was in Aston Martin DB11 at the time. So I've got to buy that. I'm off today. And we laughed. He went, bloody hell, you deserve it. Go and get it. So I bought my dream house, which I viewed 2 years prior. Didn't have a clue how I'd get it, but I knew I had to have that house. And it was rented out and then was coming available. And I ended up buying my dream house, my dream car. I then got my other dream car with one of the earnouts thing. So I am just so blessed. It's quite sad, Carl, right? On a night, every night, every morning, I will get up and look out my window. And yes, I'm the roughest on the estate, right? I get that, no matter what, right? The lad from Gateshead. But I'm sure everyone thinks I'm a drug dealer. But it's like, oh yeah, I'm so blessed, I'm so humbled, and I'm so grateful. I've got, you know, great family around us, great girlfriend, you know, kids, fab. Cam's a YouTuber, and Miles is doing fantastic. And Rebecca's got two kids, Charlotte Marks as well, great kids. So I'm blessed. I really am blessed. So my level of appreciation now is far more than it has ever been. But I'm only getting started. I'm only scratching the surface.
You've talked a few times about feeling blessed.
Yeah.
Your specific phrase. Are you religious?
So I went to a Catholic school and I never went, and I was one of them when, guess what I was doing when Mass was on? Playing football. And I never went to church. And just over the last few years, I'm absolutely believe 100% in God. So I do. But I don't go to church. I don't do anything like that. But just every night I say thanks. Not can I have this, can I have that? And it's like, thank you.
Do you pray when you are saying thanks? Or is it just something that you think?
So no, just every night. Every night I'll have my 5 minutes saying thank you. And people who watch this will go, what, him? Oh, the hell's he? Like, but because of the persona and stuff, I absolutely believe. But like I say, I don't go to church or anything like that, but yeah.
Fair. And of course, when you, within 6 years, went from bankrupt to selling your business for millions, clearly that gave you that financial independence. Just tell us a little bit about sort of where you are now, i.e. what's occurred since that point where you became financially independent again for the second time.
Yes, well, so when I sold the business, I sold it for a life-changing amount, and then I was given shares on the private equity-backed platform. So platform business, come on board. When I wanted to sell Smart, we were losing $400,000 a year. And I knew there was value in the business by our order book.
Yep.
And I said, right, we're going to go from -$400,000, we'll go to 1.1 million profit in 1 year. And in 1 year, we're going to go from that and we're going to sell this business or get a trade sale. A private equity sale. We were too small for private equity. I said, that's what's going to happen. And at the time, I said, my business partner, look, you've got to get out of my way and just let me drive this like crazy. And to be fair to them, they did, and obviously I always have that support and sound ideas, but the day-to-day run, I drove it like crazy every day. And within that, halfway through, bear in mind, you know, in 12 months, you know, the odds of this happening, of getting your business survive 5 years is 1 in 10. Your chance of, from losing money, 1 in 10, your chance of selling it, your chance of selling for multi-million, so I've added that up. It's about one in a million chance, God. But I was the one, right? So which I knew, I'm the one, I will make this happen. And we actually, the money was in my bank in 13 months. And I had four buyers. We're sitting from the five people, we got four of us, down to two. And then we pick. But they give us shares in their business. The deal was, had to stay. They then exited back in. So I've sold my business first time. I'll have sold, on this journey, I'll have sold my business three times in a year. And probably the next exit will be the biggest payday, which is mental, isn't it?
And when do you think that next exit will come?
So again, you know, that if you look at private equity, you know more than anyone, between 3 and 7 years, which means on average a 5-year vehicle. So if you went on the averages, it will be 3-year time. But I was ready to go. So the second exit was in February 23. I already said there's a group structure, and I'm the CEO of my business, so there's 4 or 5 businesses in there, and then there's a group CEO. And I said to Paul, look, that's me done. I'm finished, I'm done. There's other stuff I want to do. He said, Peter, come and see us in London, just have breakfast, and come meet the new owners and see what's what. And their goal is, so the second exit, we sold for triple digit millions. This exit's going to be like a unicorn, so £1 billion plus. So what the plan obviously to grow this, and not understanding private equity as such, that you can actually sit there, I'll have sold my business 3 times in 8 years, which is mental, absolutely mental. And I was really bored into on this. When I was due to go the second exit and do my own thing, I was really bored into, right, okay, go do one more exit. I really could do, especially the first year. And I went, right, okay, I'll commit, I will do this final, and then I'm gone. And I'm still doing my property projects, so I'm having to go. I lost everything in property, Carl. Yeah, I did a little bit of a refurb last year with 3 houses. Worked a treat. So now I'm in for some, you know, getting out of your comfort zone. I'm about to buy a great 2-listed building, change it into 35 apartments. I should have completed 2 weeks ago, but there's something on the searches that we need to sort. But yeah, so it's getting out of comfort zone, keep going, but that's where the journey is in the business now. And the goal for when I know how to set businesses up to exit, and it's like having this superpower now where you go, right, I know what to do. Like, I'd love to help other people do that and get that exit, because I'm speaking to the master here, but when you go through it yourself, you know this, how to set up a business to sell. And when I sold my business, right, I'll tell you, because it's about my sales process. My sales process is different than everyone else. When I was selling a business, one of the stories was, I was in a room, obviously bigger than this, and I'm sitting, there's about 22 people around with a company that's buying me. And in that room of the 22 people, there's director, 2 founders, the CEO, people officer, or just like that. And there's me, my business partner at the time, and my advisor at the time, Phil. And I went, right, okay. So break the ice. So CEO Hughes, that's my name at the minute. So we'll start off with that. And then the first question was, so Peter, why do you think you're the greatest field sales operation in the UK? That was my business, Smart. And why do you think you're so important to us? Now, and this is a lesson for anyone. Everyone, the 99.9% of people will say at that point, what would you say there, Carl, if said, you tell me, you know, so why are you so important to us, and why are you the best field sales and operation in the UK? Most people will go, well, why we're the best? And people, if they're watching it, they'll be going, well, why were the best is because X, Y, Z.
They sell the USPs of their business at that point.
But I need to understand what's in your head.
I said,
great question. I said, but why do you think?
Yeah, why are you set up
with a great field sales? And why do you think we're so important? Yeah. So they then said, well, why I think you're so important, one of the things was, you reach markets we can't reach. So I have a choice at that time to get them to feel pain or pleasure. So ultimately, you give me anything that you mention, I'm allowed to ask them a question on, right? So I go, which markets are those? And how important are those markets to you? And he said, oh, well, and then I'll have a bit of fun. I'll go, and what would happen if you couldn't reach those markets? Where would it stop your growth? And if it stopped your growth, what impact would that have on the business? Well, it would... And then I'll try close. So I want you to feel pain or pleasure. I haven't got a clue. And then we talked about other stuff. And at the end of it, I then said, look, what you've said, that's why we're the best. I never presented a thing. The guys sold my business to themselves But I needed to understand what was coming out of their head. And at the end, I just said, right, so if we could come to an agreement with a little trial close at the end, come to an agreement at the right price, would you buy us? And the smile, the laugh went, of course you not. So I never presented a thing there, Cole. I never said a thing about us. But I needed to do that because I'm really interested. I need to know that I'm not selling you a size 9 shoe when you're after a size 7 flip-flop. But that's the difference in sales. People think in their head they've got a great deal. Yes, in my head, I ain't got a clue what's in your head until I... And that's what I read all these sales books. I'm going, they're just presenters. A little tiny little fuck find presenters. You can't, your fuck finds everything. It's something called an explicit need. There's a difference what I do in sales. So I find the need, establish it, and then make it explicit. So,
and that's a phenomenal insight. And a lot of people who are looking to sell a business,
yep,
or the people who are selling services or products,
yep,
into the field, people who are trying to get people to do things for the good of them and their business,
yes,
will be putting a square peg into a round hole.
Totally.
As you say, it's a direct consequence of not asking the right question, yep, in the right way to give you knowledge to leverage.
Yes.
So
yes,
that insight, Peter, will be invaluable,
yes,
to our viewers. Yep. And of course, that's not just when selling a business, that's when selling anything.
Yep.
You need to know,
totally,
who you're selling to first,
totally,
is the point, and their reasons for buying.
Absolutely.
Before you then present back.
It's even if you're coaching someone.
That's right.
So you need to know what's important. Why are you at this job? And why is that important? Why did you first choose this? And what do you want to get? And I want to do for my family. Or what do you want to do? Well, I want to go on holiday or whatever. And what would happen if you got that holiday? How would your family feel? Well, so how important is it that you work hard in order to get that dream holiday? You know, that type of thing. So you've got to get people to come. My mum used to say it was, what you should be doing, right? Give us advice. And you know what it's like, mums and dads, and it's the same in business. If someone tells you something, you're like...
And you withdraw, don't you?
And it might be great advice.
Mm.
But because you bloody tell us, I'm not interested. But if you'd asked, look, what could you do? What could you have done better today, Peter? What could you? If you got me to come up with it, I would give you. So, and this happens in business a hell of a lot. As people tell, and you see people like that. You've got to stop that. And when you're selling a business, you'll have in your mind, why are you brilliant? Why are the best business for you to buy? But until you know what's interesting for them, what is it really? I mean, you're not going to maximize your multiple, your value, everything on that. You've got to get other people to see it. So that is one thing I would say. And if I ever helped anybody sell their business, that is one thing I would absolutely insist on, that you find out their need, if that makes sense.
It makes absolute sense. Peter, I could literally sit here all day, but sadly, our viewers probably can't, and time is going to run short. I've got one last question,
yeah,
before we wrap up this podcast. Obviously, you mentioned... I'm sorry to talk negatively, but it's for a positive reason. You mentioned that when you were declared bankrupt,
yes,
you showed your business partner,
yes,
your bank statement,
yes,
and it had pence,
yeah,
not even pounds,
yes,
let alone tens of pounds,
yeah,
tens of,
yes,
thousands of pounds or millions. So obviously now, after this podcast, you may go to the local cash point and you may get a bank statement. When you look at that bank statement, what does that mean to you now?
You're not even starting. You're not even scratching the surface. So I've got an idea, and I've told you about it before. I've got, I believe, 100 million idea. Believe, because now I know how to do it and scale at different sizes of sales. I'm not even getting warmed up.
So what's coming next for you? So when we sit down in 5 years' time,
so I've made
on this podcast,
yes,
what,
yes,
will we be talking about you having achieved?
So yeah, so I need, we're on this planet, you know, you're on this planet, it's mental. If you're lucky to live from 0 to 80, you live for 4,000 weeks.
A lot of time if you use it.
It's like, is that all? In half, you know, half of them, you're asleep for half of that time. So it's like life is for living. I've got this period now, 50, 49, sorry, I'm still 49, though Let's wonder. I only look 40 and a half. I know that.
I'll be the judge on that, Peter.
Need to get these cameras a little bit out. It's like that. He said he looks 72, fella.
Blame the lighting.
Need all the help I can get. And I've got this 10-year period now, I think, which is my footballing prime, yep, but business prime,
yep,
with everything I've learned. So when I start something, we'll get to this next exit and we'll get that done, dusted. After this, I'm starting not from scratch, I'm starting from experience.
Yep.
And if I don't scale and I know how to grow stuff, I've got that passion, I believe I've got, you know, the sales process that can help. I may even get involved with other businesses and help them scale and exit. Scale and exit, that's what, or acquisitions or whatever. So it'll be interesting where we'll be in a few years. But one thing is for sure, I'll not be putting my feet up and I'll still be on a Wednesday night playing football, still wanting to be the best against all these younger people. So, that's where I think I'll be. And I just think, again, like if you want it badly enough, you find a way and you never, ever give up. Because there'll be people now in adversity in business watching this, right? And then they'll be challenged it. And this is the most important. If it was that easy, everybody would do it, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Right. Totally. So you've got to get better at asking better questions. Because there's an answer to everything. Surround yourself with the right people. Ask better questions. And you never give up till you win. Simple as that. So there we go. If that's right or wrong.
Peter, genuinely, it's been one of the most inspiring, most honest, most no-nonsense podcasts I've ever had the pleasure of participating in. So massive thanks for your time. I hope our viewers can take one learning at least away from this podcast. But for now, happy birthday for next week. And I look forward to sitting down in 5 years' time.
Brilliant.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure spending some quality time with Peter Kirkham today on our Confessions of an Entrepreneur podcast. It's brilliant to understand a little bit more about how Peter's parents were able to support and encourage him as a young sportsman as he pursued his dream to become a professional footballer. It was sad, but of course inspiring similarly, to hear a little bit more about how post his footballing career, he went from one property to 60 properties in no time, losing everything and declaring himself optionally bankrupt. And how from that, he dug deep, perhaps took some counsel from friends, and was able to then, within 6 years from startup, sell his business for millions of pounds. The business today, he still is a shareholder in and CEO of. Without doubt, Peter has to be one of the most inspiring, most candid, most motivated, focused, no-nonsense individuals, entrepreneurs, and business persons I've had the pleasure of having on my podcast. Peter not only is someone I can relate to, because everyone has challenges, but also someone who I hope continues to be successful in his endeavours, because for sure, he on a daily basis works harder than most, improves probability of success as a consequence, deserves it. You've been watching Confessions of an Entrepreneur, powered by RG. My name is Carl Swansbury. If you would like to download this podcast or any other podcast in this series, please go to wherever you consume your podcast from. But for now, we look forward to seeing you on future Confessions of an Entrepreneur/CEO podcasts.